Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Welcome back to the Bareback Facts, everybody. I am your host, Dallas, otherwise known on Straight Football Talk as Big D, and today I have a treat for you. Today we're going to be talking about Ivan the Terrible, a figure who is surrounded by controversy even to this day, but a figure who is no doubt instrumental in the formation of the nation of Russia as we know it today. Now, for those of you who are first-time listeners, I would like to remind you all that today our call-in number is 718-508-9883. And without further ado, let's get started. Let's take a bite of this. Who was Ivan the Terrible, and why do they call him that? Well, Ivan was born as Ivan Vasilyevich, born on August 25th, 1530, near Moscow in what would be today Russia, and he would die on March 18th, 1584, in Moscow. He was born the Grand Prince of Moscow, and he ruled from 1533 to 1584. He is the first man to be proclaimed Tsar of Russia. He himself proclaimed himself that. For those of you unfamiliar with the term Tsar, it is the roughly translated into Caesar. Emperor. Now he proclaimed from that point, from 1547 onward, is the time at which he referred to himself as the Tsar. His reign saw the completion of the construction of a centrally administered Russian state and the creation of an empire that included non-Slavic states. Ivan himself would engage in prolonged and largely unsuccessful wars against both Sweden and Poland, and in seeking to impose military discipline and a centralized administration, he instituted a reign of terror against the hereditary nobility known as the Boyars. So why would he do such a thing? How did he become the man he was? Well, Ivan himself was born the son of Grand Prince Vasily III of Moscow and his second wife, Yelena Glonskaya. Now, he was to become the penultimate representative of the Rurik dynasty. Now, on December 4th, 1533, immediately after his father's death, the three-year-old Ivan, that is Ivan the Terrible, was proclaimed Grand Prince of Moscow, or Muscovy. His mother ruled in Ivan's name until her death, and she was allegedly poisoned by the other nobles known as the Boyars, who were a group of men in the warrior caste, nobles, if you will, in the year 1538. Now, the death of both of Ivan's parents served to reanimate the struggles of various factions of nobles for control of the person of the young prince and for power. The years 1538 to 1547 were thus a period of murderous strife among the clans of the warrior caste we've commonly been referring to as the Boyars. Their continual struggles for the reins of government to the detriment of the realm had made a profound impression on Ivan and imbued him with a lifelong dislike of the Boyars, which we'll circle back to later on. Now, on January 16th, 1547, Ivan was crowned Tsar and Grand Prince of all of Russia. The title Tsar was derived from the Latin title Caesar, as I referenced earlier, and was translated by Ivan's contemporaries as Emperor. In February of the same year, Ivan married Anastasia Romanovna, a great aunt of the future first Tsar of the Romanov dynasty. It's a mouthful there. Apologize for that, guys. Since 1542, Ivan had been greatly influenced by the views of the Metropolitan of Moscow, Makary, who encouraged the young Tsar in his desire to establish a Christian state based on the principles of justice. Ivan's government soon embarked on a wide program of reforms and of the reorganization of both central and local administration. Church councils summoned in 1547 and in 1549 strengthened and systemized the church's affairs, affirming its orthodoxy and canonizing a large number of Russian saints. In the year 1549, the first Zemsky Sobor was summoned to meet in an advisory capacity. Now, this was a national assembly composed of boyars, clergy, some elected representatives of the new service gentry, and just, you know, a collection of his lesser nobles as well. Now, in 1550, a new, more detailed legal code was drawn up that replaced the one dating from 1497. Russia's central administration was also reorganized into departments, each responsible for a specific function of the state. So this is where Ivan has begun to realize that things are a little out of hand. It's time to organize things. Let's get things together. So he begins dividing the government up into sections so he has an easier control over things, has a better understanding. He's got ministers in charge of things now, and things are starting to come together for him. The conditions of military service were improved, the armed forces were reorganized, and the system of command altered so that commanders were appointed on merit rather than simply by virtue of their noble birth, naturally ruffling some feathers. The government also introduced extensive self-government with the district administrators elected by the local gentry. Now, these two things were clear moves by Ivan early on in his reign to try and strip the boyars of as much power as possible. So as you can see, one of the things that Ivan is influenced by early on is the death of both of his parents at such a young age. Remember that he becomes grand prince of the country at the age of 3, and it isn't long after that that his mother dies, and he's forced to take control and take responsibility for his entire country. It's a lot to thrust onto a young person. Okay, so he himself is forced to reign early on at a very young age. He's thrust into power, and he sees during the time in which he's trying to sort of consolidate himself in the wake of his parents' death, and it should be noted that many historians have said that it is likely that boyars poisoned his mother, and this may have also been suspected by Ivan, thus further increasing his dislike for the boyars. But nonetheless, he saw the boyars struggling for power and struggling to get his attention, to get control of him, to take over the country, and he saw the depths which they were willing to stoop to get what they wanted. And this immediately had an impression upon him that he must strip these people of as much power as possible. In his mind, they were the most dangerous and detrimental thing to not only his rule, but to the people. Now, one of the objects, as I have already stated, of his reforms was to limit the powers of the hereditary aristocracy of princes and boyars who held their estates on a hereditary basis. So obviously right off the bat, as I've already kind of broke down, one of the major objectives of his reforms was to strip the nobles and boyars of power so they can no longer threaten his rule. The second was to promote the interests of the service gentry who held their landed estates solely as compensation for their service to the government and who were thus dependent on the Tsar. So the Tsar himself is giving out land. So Ivan himself is giving out land, giving out property to people who are serving his interests. This gives him a direct hold on them because at any time he can strip them of their land and titles. Now, Ivan apparently aimed at forming a class of landed gentry that would owe everything to him. All the reforms took place under the aegis of the so-called Chosen Council, an informal advisory body in which the leading figures were the Tsar's favorites, one Alexei Adachev and the priest Sylvester. The council's influence waned and then disappeared in the early 1560s, however, after the death of Ivan's first wife and of Makari, by which time Ivan's views and his entourage had changed. Ivan's first wife, Anastasia, died in 1560, and only two male heirs by her, Ivan, born in 1554, and Fyodor, born in 1557, survived the rigors of medieval childhood. Important to note that in the Middle Ages, childhood was not an easy thing by any stretch of the imagination to survive. Childbirth itself could be incredibly traumatic, and many babies were lost in childbirth, including, and not just babies, but women as well. In addition, you have to understand that during this time, there's no central heating, really. There's a lot of, you know, medicine's not as advanced at this time. So getting a cold, getting sick, kill you as a child. So medieval teenagers and medieval adults, they were badasses. They had to survive a lot of things. So even the average medieval person was probably a lot tougher than we would be now. Now, Russia was at war for the greater part of Ivan's reign. Muscovite rulers, and of course it would be noted that it should be noted that Muscovite is in reference to the fact that his principality at the time was known as Muscovy. They had long feared incursions by the Tatars. And in 1547 to 1548, as well as in 1550, as well as in the years 1549 to 1550, they waged unsuccessful campaigns against the hostile Khanate of Kazan on the Volga River. Now, in 1552, after lengthy preparations, the Tsar set out for Kazan, and the Russian army then succeeded in taking the town by assault of a moving fortress, by the way, a fortress that they uprooted, brought over there, and then attacked from. Very impressive workmanship on their part. Now, in 1556, the Khanate of Astrakhan, located at the mouth of the Volga, was annexed without a fight. From that moment onward, the Volga became a Russian river, and the trade route to the Caspian Sea was rendered safe. Important to note that he would later commemorate the victory in Kazan with the building of the St. Basil Cathedral. So, kind of a big deal. He's kind of a big deal at this point. So as we move forward, look at war on his list, known as the Livonian War. Now, with the banks of the Volga now secured, Ivan prepared for a campaign to force an exit to the sea. A traditional concern of Russia early on in its infancy was that they were landlocked. Ivan felt that trade with the rest of Europe depended on free access to the Baltic Sea, and decided to turn his attention westward. In 1558, he went to war in an attempt to establish Russian rule over Livonia, which is now present-day Latvia and Estonia. Russia was victorious in the early goings of the war. They succeeded in destroying the Livonian Knights, but their ally, Lithuania, became an integral part of Poland in 1569, and then the war began to drag on. While the Swedes supported Poland against Russia, the Crimean Tatars attacked Astrakhan and even made an extensive incursion into Russia in 1571, where they then burned Moscow, leaving only the Kremlin standing when Stephen Bathory of Transylvania became king of Poland in 1575 and reorganized Polish armies under his leadership. For those of you familiar with my show, you might know who Stephen Bathory is, because he is, in fact, the husband a member of a very influential line. He is related to Elizabeth Bathory. So, those of you unfamiliar with her, you might want to check out that episode. A little bit of a segue there. Now, back on track. He became king of Poland in 1575, reorganized their armies under his leadership, and they were able to carry the war for the first time onto Russian territory, while the Swedes recaptured parts of Livonia. Ivan at last asked Pope Gregory XIII to intervene, and through the mediation of his nuncio Antonio Pasavino, an armistice with Poland was concluded on January 15th in 1582. Now, under its terms, Russia had to surrender all its gains in Livonia, and an armistice with Sweden in 1583 compelled Russia to give up towns on the Gulf of Finland. The 24-year-long war had proved fruitless for Russia, which was exhausted by the long struggle. At this point, things are not going too well for Ivan, and Ivan has decided to change tactics. Ivan was actually known for having a bit of a quirky
and relatively unpredictable personality. But before we get into where things changed for Ivan, we're going to take a commercial break. And it behooves me to mention to you all that we have a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's crazy, he's funny, and he's incredibly entertaining. You want to check out ChrisBraileyPresents.com. And when we come back, we'll talk about what made Ivan so terrible in the later goings of his reign.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraileyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to the Bear Back Facts. Hope you guys enjoyed the commercial break. And guys, now that we've returned, a little bit of a pickup from where we left off. Guys, I mentioned the fact that the Livonian War had devastating consequences for Ivan and his people. The war ultimately lasted 24 years, and it was unsuccessful. They lost all their gains. They had to give up territory, and people were quite tired of war. So Ivan became incredibly disappointed, and when Ivan was disappointed, bad things tended to happen. And by bad things, I mean executions. Ivan's first executions apparently rose out of his disappointment over the course of the Livonian War and the suspected treason of several boyars who he believed were working against him. The defection of one of his long-standing, outstanding field commanders, Prince Andrei Kerbsky, to Poland in 1564 greatly startled the Tsar, who announced later that year his intention of abdicating in view of the boyars' betrayal. The Muscovites, however, led by the clergy, implored him to continue to rule, and in 1565 he acceded to their request on condition that he should be allowed to deal with the traitors as he wished and that he should form an oprichnika, which is an aggregate of territory that would be administered separately from the rest of the put under his immediate control as crown land. Now, the oprichnika was his attempt to isolate who he believed were the traitors to his reign. A bodyguard of 1,000 to 6,000 men known as the oprich, but he should form an oprichnina, which is an aggregate, which is the territory that he created. It's a partitioned area of land in which he was hoping to isolate it from the rest of his state in order to root out the people that he was a little bit disappointed with. Now, in response to this, he also added a personal guard of roughly 1 to 6,000 men known as the oprichniki. This was raised, and specified towns and districts all over Russia were included in the oprichnina, their revenues being assigned to the maintenance of the Tsar's new court and household, which consisted of a number of carefully selected boyars and service gentry. Ivan lived exclusively in this entourage and withdrew from the day-to-day management of Russia's administrative apparatus, now called the Zemshchina, or the land, which he left in the hands of leading boyars and bureaucrats. Ivan cut himself off from almost all communication with them, and while the oprichniki trampled with impunity on everyone beyond Ivan's immediate circle. Now, the purpose of the oprichniki were to inspire fear. They were essentially a personal guard, but also a secret police. Now, since nearly all the documents relating to this epoch were destroyed in one of Moscow's periodic fires, historians tend to give differing explanations for Ivan's action during this part of his reign. The majority tend to the view that the struggle between the Tsar and the old hereditary nobility, which was jealous of surrendering its power and privileges, had resisted his internal reforms and military projects. The oprichnina may thus have been his attempt to create a highly centralized state and destroy the economic strength and political power of the princes and high nobility. The increasingly resentful boyars had indeed opposed Ivan and plotted against him on many occasions, but the reign of terror that Ivan initiated by the oprichnina proved far more dangerous to the stability of the country than the danger that it was designed to suppress. In the year 1570, Ivan personally led his oprichniki troops against Novgorod, destroying that city and executing several thousand people who inhabited it. Many boyars and the other members of the gentry perished during this period, some being publicly executed with calculated and symbolic cruelty. Ivan later sent to various monasteries memorials of more than 3,000 of his victims, most of whom were executed in the course of the oprichnina. This only lasted 7 years, from 1565 to 1572, when it was abolished as a result of the failure of the regiments to defend Moscow from attack by the Crimean Tartars. The oprichnina army was reintegrated with that of the Zemshchina, and some of the estates confiscated by Ivan's followers were returned to their owners. The entire episode leaves a bloody imprint on Ivan's reigns, causing some doubts about his mental stability and leaving historians with the impression of a morbidly suspicious and vindictive ruler. So who were the oprichniki? So the oprichniki themselves was a term given to a member of the oprichnina, an organization which was established by the Tsar, Ivan the Terrible, to govern a division of Russia for this 7-year period from 1565 to 1572. Now, Some scholars believe that Ivan's second wife, the Circassian Maria Tambruknova, was the first who had had the idea of forming the organization. But this theory comes from one Heinrich von Staden, a German Oprichnik. Now, he was also her brother and also became a leading Oprichnik. They were required to swear an oath of allegiance directly to the Grand Prince, and it went as follows. I swear to be true to the Lord, Grand Prince, and his realm, to the young Grand Princes, and to the Grand Princess, and not to maintain silence about any evil that I may know or have heard or may hear which is being contemplated against the Tsar, his realms, the young princes, or the Tsaritsa. I also swear not to eat or drink with the Zemshina and not to have anything in common with them. On this I kiss the cross. Now, these men were sworn directly in the service of the royal family, and they were not to have anything to do with the everyday person except to listen to them, spy on them. That's it. That was their purpose. Now, there are many theories about these individuals. Modern theories suggest that the motivating purpose for the organization and their existence was to suppress people or groups opposed to the Tsar. They were known to ride black horses and were led by Ivan himself on many occasions. They were known to terrorize civilian populations. By many individuals, perhaps not in their earshot, though, as the Tsar's dogs, because of their actions and blind loyalty. They were said to dress in black garb, similar to a monastic habit, bearing the insignia of a severed dog's head to sniff out treason and the enemies of the Tsar, and a broom to sweep them away. The dog's head was also symbolic of nipping at the heels of the Tsar's enemies. The Oprichniki were ordered to execute anyone disloyal to Ivan and used various methods of torture to do so, and they were ordered to do so on the spot. If you were discovered to have spoken out against the Tsar, if you were discovered to have been suspected by an Oprichniki of having disrespected the Tsar or his family, these are some of the methods you might find yourself suffering, ultimately leading to your death. So they include tying each limb to a different horse and riding in opposite directions. Some individuals were placed into a boiling cauldron and boiled alive. Other individuals were impaled, and some were roasted to death by being tied over poles held over open fires. When Ivan himself declared himself the hand of God, he selected 300 of the Oprichniki to be his personal brotherhood and to live in his castle near Vladimir. Now, 4 a.m., these selected Oprichniki attended a sermon given by Ivan himself, then performed the day's ritual executions. The Oprichniki sought to lead an externally aesthetic lifestyle like the monks they emulated, but it was punctuated by acts of cruelty and debauchery. Ivan was also said to have often sang while his Oprichniki ate, eating only when they had finished, and roughly at 9 p.m. in the evenings, he went to bed listening to stories told by three blind men. In the Novgorod incident, the Oprichniks killed an estimated 1,500 people that were noble or big people, although the actual number of victims is today still unknown. It's estimated to be anywhere between the 7-year period in which they operated. It's estimated that they killed anywhere between 1,000 to 6 or 7,000 people. Now, by 1572, they had become a destabilizing force, and they were disbanded personally by Ivan, and it thus later became a capital offense to say or discuss the term Oprichniki or Oprichna. So, this is kind of where we're at with Ivan the Terrible and the Oprichniki. This is a pretty dark period of time for the people of Russia. Now, important to note, that after they murdered peasants and nobles and conscripted men to fight further in the war in Livonia, after the 7-year period in which they operated and were disbanded, there were some other severe problems that faced Ivan and his kingdom. Depopulation and famine began to ensue, and what had by far been the richest area of Russia soon became the poorest. In a dispute with the Novgorod Republic, Again, I mentioned that I'm so sorry, I stumbled there. The Opritchniks were ordered to murder the inhabitants of the city, and there are estimates that there were tens of thousands of people who ultimately would be killed in this. Among them were approximately 1,500 to 3,000 nobles, but supposedly tens of thousands of people were killed during this time. But we're never going to know probably for sure how many people were killed, because unfortunately a lot of those documents were destroyed. The official death toll during this time only mentions about 1,500 1,500 nobles, and only mentions about the same number of smaller people. Now, in 1581, it said that Ivan accidentally killed his own son, but the death of his son is actually heavily disputed today. Many people don't believe that he actually did that. Some people still say that he did, but I think that's mainly to enhance this concept of him being such a terrible person. Because in the early stages of his reign, you can see that Ivan's definitely trying to make things better for people in general, not just himself. Yes, he's trying to strip people of power, but you can also see that Ivan is elevating people. He's making it possible for people to rise. Now, upon Ivan's death, the ravaged kingdom was left with his unfit and childless son, Theodore. Now, Ivan himself left behind a little bit of a sad legacy, I dare say. But following the actions of the Opritchnina, here is what we know about his life. Now, withdrawal and flight are themes that run through the later years of Ivan's reign. Ivan expressed an interest in establishing diplomatic and trade relations with England, even suggesting his readiness to marry an English noblewoman. In 1575, it seems that he abdicated for about a year in favor of a Tatar prince, Simeon Bekbul. Now, during the 1570s, he married five wives in succession in only 9 years. Finally, though, in a fit of rage, according to some reports, he actually killed his only heir, which was Ivan. Though, again, many people suggest that there's more to the story than that. Some people say that Ivan was actually unhealthy, but again, it's one of those things that makes things a little bit more controversial. One of the things that makes Ivan a little bit more interesting. But this set the clock ticking for the political crisis known as the Time of Troubles that began with the extinction of the Rurik dynasty upon the infirm Fyodor's death in 1598. So what is the legacy of Ivan? Ivan's achievements were many. In foreign policy, all his actions were directed towards forcing Russia into Europe, a line that Peter the First, or Peter the Great, was to continue. Internally, Ivan's reign of terror, however, eventually resulted in the weakening of all levels of the aristocracy, including the service gentry that he had initially sponsored. The prolonged and unsuccessful Livonian War overextended the state's resources and helped bring Russia to the verge of an economic collapse. These factors, together with the Tatar incursions, resulted in the depopulation of a number of Russian provinces by the time of Ivan's death, whether by people fleeing or by people just being dead or by people starving to death. Unfortunately, you have to say it that way, but that is the way things go, unfortunately. Again, Ivan dies in 1584. Nevertheless, he left his realm far more centralized, both administratively and culturally, than it had ever been previously. Ivan also encouraged, during his rule, Russia's cultural development, especially through printing and architecture. He himself wrote very well, and though his surviving writings are mainly of a political nature, his command of words and his biting sarcasm are incredibly evident in all of his writing. Ivan was a devout adherent of the Orthodox Church, and his goals ultimately were to create a state in the guise, basically to create the new Jerusalem on earth. That was his goal. His arguments on religious questions are striking in their power and conviction, but he placed the most emphasis on defending the divine right of the ruler to unlimited power under God, a view with which most other monarchs of the time would have likely been in agreement. Nevertheless, a very controversial figure, a guy that definitely left his mark on history in more ways than one. certainly a guy that you don't want to cross by any stretch of the imagination. So let's there was a couple of things, though, that I wanted to go back over before we call it a day. So we did miss a things here. Got some talking points here. One second. Ah. There we are. Important to note, I should say it's important to note that Ivan completely altered, forever and completely altered, Russia's governmental structure, establishing the character of modern Russian political organization. Ivan's creation of the Oprichnina, answerable only to him, not only afforded him personal protection, but curtailed the traditional powers and rights of the boyars. Henceforth, czarist autocracy and despotism would lie at the heart of the Russian state forever. Ivan bypassed the Mestnitsovo system and offered positions of power to his supporters among the minor gentry, and the empire's local administration combined with locally and centrally appointed officials. The system proved durable and practical and sufficiently flexible to tolerate later modification. While his expedition against Poland failed at a military level, it helped Russia extend its trade, political, and cultural links with Europe. And these connections were, again, built on by Peter the Great in his bid to make Russia a major European power. At his death, the empire encompassed the Caspian Sea to the southwest and Siberia to the east. Southwards, his conquest ignited several conflicts with expansionist Turkey, whose territories were thus confined to the Balkans and the Black Sea regions. Ivan's management of Russia's economy, however, again, as I mentioned, proved disastrous both in his lifetime and after. He had inherited a government in debt, and in an effort to raise more revenue for his expansionist wars, he instituted a series of increasingly unpopular and burdensome taxes. Successive wars drained Russia of manpower and resources, bringing it to the brink of ruin. After his death, his empire's nearly ruined economy contributed to the decline of his own dynasty, leading to the time. Ivan's notorious outbursts and autocratic whims helped characterize the position of Tsar as one accountable to no earthly authority, only to God. Tsarist absolutism faced new serious challenges until the 19th century. Late in the 19th century, I might add. Ivan's legacy was manipulated by communist Russia as a potential focus for nationalist pride. His image became closely associated with the personality of the cult of Joseph Stalin, we talked about. While early Soviet Marxist-Leninist historiography attached greater significance to the socioeconomic forces than the political history and role of individuals, Stalin wanted official historians to make Russia's history comprehensible and accessible to the populace, with an emphasis on those great men, such as Ivan and Peter the Great, who had strengthened and expanded the Russian state. In modern post-Soviet Russia, a campaign has been run to seek the granting of sainthood to Ivan IV, and the Russian... important to note that the Russian Orthodox Church is opposed to this idea. And why would they not be opposed to the idea? Even though Ivan did a great many things, he was still an asshole. Much like many of the nobles and monarchs throughout history, even though he did a lot of cool stuff, he was still, at the end of the day, a bit of an asshole. So what did we learn today, kids? There is a reason that Ivan the Terrible was called Ivan the Terrible, and it's not necessarily because he was incredibly cruel. It's because he was a shitty monarch. Ivan, ultimately, at the end of the day, was so obsessed with creating this new Jerusalem on earth, this new kingdom of God, that he didn't pay attention to any of his advisors. He just invaded countries on whims, killed people he thought were disagreeing with him, whether they did or not. And the only real solid thing that he did, the only really good things that he did ultimately as far as, for his people, was making it possible for people to be elevated. But although they, in order to elevate themselves, they had to kiss his ass, which was kind of par for the course with monarchs during this time. But other than that, the only things notable that we can point to for him was establishing a stronger emphasis on Russian culture and Russian writing, as well as Russian architecture. So these are about the only things that we can look to for Ivan that are kind of redeemable things. The idea of centralizing his government and sort of organizing the territory, that's all well and good. But he was still an asshole the whole time he did it. He killed a lot of people, and he drove his country into the ground economically with his expensive and increasingly more stupid wars that he chose to be a party to. So Ivan the Terrible may have earned his nickname, not because he was incredibly cruel, not because of some of the legendary stories about his rage, but because Ivan was a terrible leader. Ultimately, he was the first Tsar of Russia, and he reminds us why the Tsars of Russia eventually fall to communism, because they were so bad that the people were willing to go with any change at all by the time communism and Bolshevikism begins to rise up in Russia. Towards the end of the 19th century and going into the 20th century, you see them fall apart. And this is actually towards the end of the First World War. When this happens, you see the Bolsheviks seize power, seize control of the government, and you can see why this happens. 500 years of this bullshit, and you'd be pretty upset too. Ivan wasn't around for 500 years, but he basically drove his entire kingdom into the ground. It took years and years of hard work by guys like Peter and Catherine and rulers like Catherine the Great to eventually sort of bring this country back a little bit to a point where people weren't in such bad shape. But even after reforms and even after loads and loads of work on their part, they still struggled. And the common people never really truly formed. These reforms tended to really only benefit the people of the higher classes. And that's kind of par for the course during the Middle Ages. To be not noble during the Middle Ages was kind of to get the short end of the stick. You were either born noble and born into a position where you could affect real change in society, or you were born poor and you basically just had to shut up and soldier. So that's all I've got for you guys today. Give you a little bit of reading material to go check out if you're interested in learning a little bit more about Ivan the Terrible and a little bit more about the Russian about Russian history in the early going. So let's take a look-see here at some of the source material, give you guys something to check out. I would, first of all, like to recommend that you take a look at, where did it go? The Image of Ivan the Formidable in Russian Folklore, The Cult of Ivan the Formidable in Stalin's Russia. Both are good books, and both by Maureen Perry. They both look at how Russian people viewed Ivan in different periods. You look at the Image of Ivan in Russian Folklore, you get a little bit of an idea of how, you know, more common people were viewing Ivan. And then, of course, The Cult of Ivan the Formidable in Stalin's Russia shows us how the communists under Joseph Stalin and his government were attempting to use the image of Ivan as a symbol of Russia's greatness. So both of these are by Maureen Perry. Definitely something to take a look at. I'd also recommend Marie Andre Pavlov's Ivan the Terrible, Profiles in Power. And you can just get another book by Maureen Perry and Andre Pavlov, Ivan the Terrible. There's a number of articles dedicated to him as well. You can also take a look a number of articles dedicated to him through the Washington Post, BBC. So these are all good starts. And then finally, I'd also like to recommend Dmitry Olegovich, I should say, Russian Architecture and the West, with Yale University Press, taking a look at some of the architectural works that Ivan was responsible for inspiring. One more fun fact before I close off the day, guys, and I do hope you enjoy it. Some of the stories associated with Ivan after his death are, I think, really heavily inspired by his use of the Oprichniki. Ivan was actually said to have been prone to these bouts of just crazy. He just would fly off the handle and be crazy, which I think is unfortunate, but also what a guy, right? What do you do with this guy? One thing that's interesting is one story that's particularly been associated with Ivan was that after the conquering of Kazan and his commissioning of the building of the St. Basil Cathedral to commemorate his victory, it said that Ivan the Terrible actually blinded the architects who built it for him so that they could never build something so beautiful again. Now, this is, probably incredibly, just silly legends people came up with about Ivan. But it's interesting to note that that's how beautiful people say that St. Basil Cathedral was, so beautiful that Ivan blinded the guys who built it so they couldn't build another one. So with that, I'll leave you guys with yet another edition of the Bareback Facts. I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. I hope you learned a lot about Ivan the Terrible. Do tune in on Friday for my exclusive interview with the Cali Effect, the King of Games, famous YouTuber right now. He's doing very well. Very excited to talk to him on Friday. See you all then. And until then, enjoy the rest of your week. And for those of you who might miss the show, don't miss the show. But if you do miss the show, just like to wish you happy holidays, no matter what you're celebrating. If you're celebrating Christmas, Merry Christmas. If you're celebrating Yule, Happy Yule. Kwanzaa, whatever you're celebrating, enjoy it. Enjoy the time with your family. I'll see you all very soon.